closed position. And what's good about it is I can operate and transmit with this thing in the closed position. You know, it's an either all the way down or all the way open. You can transmit the thing, so it's not like you have to open it. Telescopic antenna everywhere, you know, every time you're going to go to use it. So, it is about 4 inches longer than the other one. So, it's got its benefits, I think. If you want that little extra bit, you're standing out there somewhere, you can extend this and probably work the IO receiver that you have trouble working. Back to
you. Okay, that's a testimonial in favor of the telescoping longer antenna moving in the direction of 5/8 waves. I think the benefit is the extra altitude, but Paul seems to feel he was getting some extra benefits. And the benefit he got, if he really got it, if he was doing an objective test, could be relevant to that particular model number of Andy talking he was using. Take 2 hours over the check test.
No, thank you very much for taking everybody on with that. That's one thing I would see if anybody has a similar sentence, you know. That seems to be a better connector than sometimes they loosen it up a little better, more breaking the connection on the side of the radio. My fire department radios are SMA or better connection. I turned around and some of my scanners they're not taking some antennas on it for longer antennas, especially when it's on the side of your body. Better, but we'll have to try some ones out that other people have there. We appreciate everybody on the net there and their opinion there and help. So, happy greetings to everyone. We'll have a good evening. And we'll catch you hopefully next Sunday. Maybe one of the will be clear on the side.
Very fine, Bob. And Bob, when you finish that survey, please come back and let us know what you found out. And by the way, you mentioned a very interesting statement there. Various people have reported that the most reproduced piece of two-way radio equipment on planet Earth over the last 20 years is the ICOM IC-2AT. Something like 2.5 million of those things have been manufactured and sold. That's the good news. One piece of bad news is that the piece of wire that goes from the output of the transmitter to the circuit board over to the BMC connector on the case of that radio is a fairly stiff, short piece of bus bar. It's wire with no insulation on it. As you wiggle the rubber duck back and forth, the semiconductor of the BMC connector gets wiggled, and eventually that wire runs into a fatigue failure of the wire, or a fatigue failure of the solder joint of the wire at one end or the other, the printed circuit end or in the BMC connector end. I have opened up my handy talkie, my particular favorite IC-2AT, and re-soldered that wire on at least 3, maybe 4 occasions. On the 5th occasion, I said, I ain't going to tolerate this. I substituted that stiff piece of bus bar with a more flexible piece of wire, and I've never had a failure ever since. But when you do have a failure of that piece of wire or its solder joint, you end up with a very nasty intermittent condition where you listen to your favorite repeater, one day it's very weak, the next day it's very strong. You eventually start wiggling the rubber duck antenna back and forth, and you realize it jumps back and forth between weak reception and strong reception. And then you've got positive proof. You've got an intermittent contact in that location. And eventually you take it apart. I'll bet you there's a large number of IC-2ATs that ended up on the surplus market because somebody said, gee, the thing doesn't have any soup anymore. It must have worn out. It's got lousy receiving capability. It's got lousy transmitting capability. They come to that conclusion. Well, properly used, properly rated transistors do not wear out. You may think so. They don't. And as such, look for something obvious. And of all those that hit the surplus market with somebody thinks something's wrong with it, the receiver is dead and the transmitter is dead, you open it up and you find out that the BMC connector wire is unsoldered or loose or broken. You re-solder it or substitute it with something more flexible of approximately the same length, and the problem will go away forever and you'll be happy and you'll get a beautiful bargain. From time to time, I see IC-2ATs being sold for numbers like $10 and $20. They originally sold for like $180 brand new. That's a lot of radio for the money. As long as you're willing to have a manual scanning, if you know what I mean, simply some wheel switches, and it's the most reliable, quick way to get on the right frequency. That's the good news. The bad news is it doesn't have a built-in PL tone generator. And almost every repeater these days is PL encoded. And as such, we have to add this extra little board inside. Well, then, how do you tune the board to the various PL frequencies when you go to various repeaters if you're in the tri-state area? I mean, New Jersey, Connecticut, you probably have a different PL tone compared to New York, which is primarily 4Z on 2 meters. So there's a little bit of a problem there. Okay, the next person was Bill, I think it is, KT2MZF. And Bill, go right ahead with your question and comment. KT2LAW in the deck net. My name's Dick.
One comment deck on that. This is KT2KY.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I had that problem of that peak breaking away from the connector. It's been on a number of handy talkies that I've worked on. To replace that stiff piece of wire, use a piece of solder wick. You know, that's a braid that they sell for removing solder from the board. They got that real thin pieces of solder wick that you buy in a little reel they come. That's the perfect thing for never break down again, never give you any problem because, there's first of all the end solder that sucks the solder in real well. And the rest of it stays, the piece stays flexible. Then you'll find you never have a problem with that situation again by using a piece of solder wick there.
Excellent solution. I like that one. I managed to find a piece of stranded wire of the right diameter and length, and it sort of solved it, but I think the solder wick of the right brand is thin enough, is probably a better solution. Go ahead, Bill. KT2MZF, KT2LAW, and check that.
My question is a little lengthy, and I need to do a little explaining to the answer. My question is right now. I've been working with and I put it in the class of
okay, I think you turned it over to us, Bill, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. Your signal was extremely weak. You started off with almost the right amount of audio, and then you started talking much more softly. And the combination of very little audio and very weak signal made copy so weak that I know you're asking a question about an HF radio. That's about as much as I've got. If you can up your power a little bit, if you can change your location a little bit, and if you can get the audio a lot heavier, I think we'll get your question. Please try again. KT2MZF, KT2RW in the deck net.
Okay, then thank you. I up my power. I can't do so. Hopefully this will work out. The question is, I purchased that radio unit for a TS-480 that I can't work with. I purchased the radio a week ago. I got it home. I borrowed the test equipment. I put it on a watt meter. I have a dummy load attached to it. I can't see power. I also turned the power down to 100 watts in case it's 300. I put the radio on a watt meter at 50 megahertz. I transmitted the watt meter read. Proper watt down. Turned it down to 28 megahertz, I think it was. Also transmitted watt. Then I go 24, 21, 80, all below. Zero results. The microphone is trying to transmit. The test has output. What is it safe to say that that radio is a part of the MCB shot below 24 megahertz? Did I get a bad radio? I'm trying to get at here.
Okay, you could definitely talk louder into that microphone. It would definitely help an awful lot, Bill. Thankfully, you went up to higher power, and now, instead of being 90% noise, you're about 75% noise. And so, I can tell that I think you're talking about a Kenwood radio. I believe you're getting approximately the right amount of power on 50 megacycles. But as you go to 28 megs, I think the power is dropping. As you go to lower frequencies, it drops even more. If I understood correctly, that's what I think you're asking. And did you get a bad radio, or do you have a bad final stage? Where the power output is decreasing with lower and lower bands, with a real watt meter into a good dummy load, and I'm assuming it's a modern-day solid-state radio where you don't have to readjust tuning and loading controls. This is an art and science to properly adjusting those. So let's assume that it's a so-called fixed-tune radio. You've got a good watt meter, And before I would condemn the radio, I would borrow somebody else's watt meter. I have seen a mode of failure that occurs in the slug of a third model 43, where even though it's rated for the lower frequency, it doesn't behave correctly at the lower frequency. It's rare, but it does happen. Before you condemn the radio, use some other method of confirming power output. If worse comes to worse, just measure the temperature rise, the rate of temperature rise of the dummy load over the right period of time. It's crude, but it can tell you the difference between the 50 watts output versus 100 watts output. A 2-to-1 difference will definitely be 10 as a different amount of heat in the dummy load. But before you condemn the radio, use some other method of power measurement. Any other brand name, any other technique. Then if you do find out the power output is dropping at lower frequencies, which is usually almost always the other way around, the radio might work beautifully at 80 meters, and it's kind of shy of power at 20 meters, really shy at 15, and boy, you're down to half power at 10 meters. Lots of people complain about that. You seem to have the opposite problem. If I heard you correctly, lots of power at 50 megs, and as you go to lower bands, it drops. And, for a final stage of a transmitter to do that, that's hard. But let's make sure that the what looks like lower power at the lower frequencies is real. If you told me that various bands jump up and down in power output as you go down the band, I'd almost accept that as a kind of a failure of the radio. But for the radio to continuously drop to lower powers as you go to lower bands, lower frequency bands, if that's what you're saying, I think that's what you're saying, boy, that's rare. You've got a 1 in 1,000 failure there. That's what it is, Bill. And so, therefore, be double darn sure it's not an instrumentation failure and you're not hitting a false alarm. Hit us with lots of audio. Eat that mic. Shout into it. You're already up at high power. I know you can't move. And so let's see if I misinterpreted what you said. KC2MZF, K2LIW in the tech man.
Okay, Dick, you have it right for the most part. I have zero power at 24 megahertz and below. 28 to 50, I'm having up to 100 watts. As soon as I go below 24 megahertz, or 24 and below, I get zero output, nothing at all. And an additional question to that is there a different band? As I change the band on the selector, it seems I hear a relay clicking inside the radio from one band to the next. Is there a different power amp for each band, or is it all operating off the same power amp? I'm very new to this.
There you go.
Somebody where you have a speaker system.
Okay. Now, that's a little bit easier to troubleshoot. Where you go below 24 megs, you get zero power. That's a lot easier to troubleshoot. You're not looking down for something that's just shy in power output. Zero power. No doubt about that. That's not a craziness of the watt meter. That sounds real. Now, many of the modern-day rigs use the exact same final stage on all frequencies, but they retune the final stage by clicking a relay. And the relay is adding a capacitor in the right spot to retune or to take out an inductor and add an inductor. It is a very well-known fact that on quite a few occasions, the relay itself will click in but not make good contact. So any method of disassembling the relay and cleaning the contact, and its watchmaker work, you've got to be very careful. Or a double-checking, in other words, I know it's not difficult, it's not easy. I wish there's a way you could get in there with an ohmmeter when you're in a certain mode of transmitting and confirm that the relay is really making the right contact. By way of the service manual, hopefully giving you a schematic diagram, you'll get some clues. But many a rig tunes to the lower band by flipping relays to add capacitance and then to change inductors and so on. And as such, the relay itself could easily fail. Either the coil itself is not sucking in, or even if the coil sucks in, sometimes the contacts don't make contact. They get the silver oxide on them or whatever as a function of time. And the relay itself either needs disassembly and cleaning, resetting of its contact mechanical position, or complete replacement of the relay. So that, in my opinion, is a very fixable item. The relay itself is probably a $5 item. When in doubt, if it was ICOM, for instance, And with the owner's manual and the schematic, you find out that the relay is called RL-14. And you simply call up ICOM in Belleville, Washington, and tell them, I'm suspicious about that relay, and I've got somebody that can re-solder it in for me. I'm just going to simply do a substitution. That would be a very worthwhile thing to do if you got about a 75 or 80% chance that it'll cure the problem. But even before doing that, I think there's ways of checking out the relay itself, tapping on it, finding out can it be disassembled and cleaned. Anyone got any further comments on this one? Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Psychological failure.
Okay. So Eric thinks that it could be logic failure. In other words, the microprocessor itself is not properly commanding the relay. In that case, Eric, do you think hitting the reset button, which is going to erase all memory, or reset the microprocessor, and then reprogram in the frequencies, the favorite frequencies, is there a chance that that could make an improvement? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's possible, but I doubt it. Most of the radios that I've worked on, usually there's like three or four address lines and a little bit of logic can obviously be like, you know, he's not getting anything below 24 megahertz, and that's all the lower than, you know. Could be like a little LS-138, a little decoder. If it was just one band, I'd be happy to say it's a relay, but, you know, the way most of those things work is multiple relays. There's large differences between bands, so that's why.
Is the radio drawing current down
here? Another good question. That sounds like Barry. So first back to Eric. Eric, if that relay driver circuit had failed, how expensive is that replacement in your opinion, Eric?
Are we talking a modern day radio, a radio that's simply years old? We're talking here. I don't mind working with surface mount. You know, modern day radio is not an impossibility. If you mind working with surface mount, send it back to the factory where somebody who can fix that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Kenwood, though, is not easy to fix. If it was ICOM, boy, the service they give hands is just something else. I know that whenever I try to buy spare parts from Kenwood, it's a bit of a rigmarole. And not many hams have sent a radio back to Kenwood for repair. They usually find some repair service that claims that they will fix Kenwood. And this is the Kenwood radio that he's talking about. Barry was asking the question, when you're in the lower band, is it drawing the same amount of current? And so if there's an ammeter on your power supply, that may give you another clue. In other words, what I think Barry is getting at is that the final stage, before you start talking into a single sideband transmitter, is biased to a certain level where it draws a certain amount of current. And hopefully the standby current in each of the bands is fairly similar. And then when you start talking, the rig draws more current as it starts putting out power. If there was something wrong with the logic of turning on the transmitter itself, the biased circuit, that you would see a substantial difference before you speak into the mic to standby bias current in, say, band 20 meters versus band 6 meters. So that's another clue, another good one. So we haven't solved your problem, but don't give up. On top of that, if you are a Limark member, Bill, you got a guy named Andy KT2WA2CDL who's got a hell of a good track record at finding faults like this and fixing them. So when you go to the next tune-up clinic at a Limark flea market, not flea market, the ham fest, and there's one coming up in June. There's a Limark ham fest coming up in 1 month, in which case you and a repair person can be face-to-face and maybe some tinkering right on the spot can take place. KT2MZF, shout into that microphone, Bill. KQYW in the TechNet.
This is KQKUY. I got a comment for him on it.
Before you go, Bill, go ahead now, Bill.
Hey, one of the guys that I know out where my daughter is out there, Mount Clan, New Jersey, had a similar problem with the radio. And he said he was losing like one band at a time. He said over a period of time, he said they let it go and then he lost the second band and all. And he was a pretty good technician. He took it apart and he said, what he found, believe it or not, on the board for some reason, possibly because the relay, you know, eventually break down because the inductor kicked up the coil, they have on the board for each relay what they call a circuit protect. It's like a fuse that's started right on the board that goes to the relay, supplies the relay with power. And what gave it away, of course, was when he put his meter from ground to the pin of the relay when switching to that band. And one side, I guess, the relay goes to ground. The other side goes to the, of course, gets the high when it's clicked in. He didn't see anything. And looking down the board, he found that the little circuit protectors that are on the board, right flat on the board, they're actually part of the surface mount of the board, one by one started to fail for some reason. They're either underrated or whatever, but they started to go bad just from being energized already.
Yeah, I can get a guess as to what could do that, Mel. A really well-designed relay circuit has a capacitor across the relay to try to control the inductive kickback, and or a reverse bias diode, again, to absorb the inductive kickback. See, when you drive the coil of a relay, the good news is current flows through it, and it sucks in the armature, and it flips from the non-contact to the contacting mode. However, the real danger of a relay is that the stored magnetic energy in that coil of that armature is substantial. At the instant you turn the relay off, it's almost like a Ford spark coil. The inductive kickback, he wants to generate all kinds of crazy voltages. So, to try to protect from that, they put resistors, capacitors, diodes across series and whatever in various places on the relay. Now, each time your relay is being commanded into the on mode, the driver circuit is instantaneously trying to put voltage on that relay, and if there's a capacitor across it, the instantaneous current of that capacitor is pretty high, even though the average is very slow. It's got a pretty fierce forward spike on the leading edge. Any kind of a fusing device in series with that is getting a momentary blast of current, but nowhere near enough to open the fuse. But you do that 1,000 times in a good long couple of QSOs over a month period of time. You're continuously thermally cycling that fuse, and because the fuse is being used correctly for average current, but incorrectly for inrush current, the fuse eventually fails. And so I've seen a lot of cases like that. So a visual observation with an ohmmeter in hand, a volt-ohm-milliammeter, going across those fuses and so on, could very easily find the problem. It's worth a try. It sounds like a beauty. KT2MZF, K2LIW in the tech net.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, tonight. I took the notes there on what you said. I'm going to look more into it. In addition to that, the radio is only about 7 months old. There may be a warranty. I got to look into a few more things. But thanks for pointing me in the right direction, because I have to put me here at home tonight to go look at it. And I'm going to try to add some audio to that and see if that helps. Thank you very much for your help. KT2MZF, 76 for now. And I will be joining you with the Lamarck next month. Thank you very much.
Hey, Bill, what change did you make? All of a sudden, you were dead full, quieting, you're potent. Did you suddenly go to a higher power? Did Mother Nature's propagation suddenly change? Where are you located? Or do you have an intermittent contact to that antenna? All of a sudden, you're loud. What'd you do?
I'm in Monmouth County, New Jersey, and I'm mobile. I'm actually outside my front. That's where I've been. All I did was, while you guys were chatting, I went to my venue. I was able to listen to you on affordable. And I went to the mic game, and I cranked it up a little bit.
Okay, so you moved to a much better location with the mobile. Alrighty, good luck with that project. Let us know how that goes. I think we've answered all the questions that the people who signed in. We saw the people who are on my list. I'm going to pass it back to you, Mel. And what are those radioactive people in Manhattan Beach doing this week? and tell us a little bit about your email. And we feel for you because I know you've got a lot of it. K2KEY. Boy, what patience. K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, I got emails, all right. I think before we get into some of the stick, and I mean just going to touch the surface, maybe a pickup call get the space report that that we get back with, because I don't want to keep you all hanging. He's very patient. He's always a great guy, but it's not fair. So let's listen to the space report, and then we'll take all the emails or as many as we can get in tonight. Over.
Station. Okay, who is this person saying station?
Yes, good evening. I wanted to be talking to you. This is Anthony. Favor in Brooklyn, WWCW.
Yes, Anthony, we're copying you quite well. Looks like you got a pretty good rig there. Go ahead.
I'm an ICOM 1332A. I'm just putting up a homebrew antenna here for the net to try to get into the Y-mark using 4 watts from HD. And it's a what's called a Super J-pole. Funny you're talking about extended antennas. It's a J-pole with a quarter wave stub fed to another half wave. And I just put two sections of wooden mast to get it above the roof line. I have full 3.5 watts forward and a quarter of the fletcher, so I was damaged.
Rather good. I would quote you 95% quieting, good audio, and so that that's 4 watts out of the handy chunky, and the Super J-pole seems to be it's working very nice for you tonight, Anthony. Good luck with that rig. Let me go over to Paul now, WS2N. Paul, I've seen, let me think now, there's two reports that I heard indirectly. Number one, the New Horizons flew by Jupiter, took a bunch of pictures of Jupiter's rings. Everybody knows that the planet Saturn's got rings, but it just did a flyby of Jupiter as part of its gravity assist on the way out to Pluto. And it took some beautiful pictures of the rings of Jupiter. A very faint ring, but we've got a high resolution camera taking good pictures up close. I can see the beautiful rings of Jupiter. WS2F, KQRIW in the second.
Okay, very good, Dick. And yeah, this is WS2N. Well, Dick, the final, yeah, I think we discussed a little bit about that, I believe, the dog of the around that system, they have these three planets that have discovered. One of them is, very large and closest to its star. And then it leaves, it's not the same size, of Earth, called the lead that would be A, the second one is B, so this is the lead. The Earth-like planet, and it's kind of remember last week. I think it was, we're 8,000 miles in diameter, and this planet is close to 12,000 miles in diameter. So five times its mass, gravity would be twice the amount if it stood on that planet. So you'd be pretty heavy, 200-pound guy with a feel himself weighing 400. That doesn't sound livable to me, Dick. But whether there's life there or not, it is the Goldilocks zone. If water exists there, it wouldn't be frozen and it wouldn't be evaporated. So it's a good place to point some telescopes and radio telescopes to see if they hear any signals coming from it. First of all, the first of all, the original astronauts that flew on all three spacecraft, the Mercury, the Gemini, and the Apollo. So that was pretty good. And at the New Horizon, that just got past Jupiter. I think the end of February, picked up an extra 9,000-mile speed to push its way all the way to Pluto. It won't have any more encounters with the other planets. Uranus and Neptune, because if you look at the layout of the planets right now, they're nowhere near the direction between the New Horizons spacecraft and where it's got to go to Pluto. Not lined up like they had with the Voyager missions, Voyager 1 and 2, when they flew past all the planets in the air, went on to Saturn and went on to Uranus, Neptune. They don't have that type of arrangement to it's not in the cards, but they had plenty of power, and it made the New Horizons spacecraft very light, and they put it on an extremely powerful spacecraft with two big solids attached to it. You know, to give you an idea, it took, what, 3-4 days for astronauts to get to the moon when they went all those flights in the Apollo days. New Horizons spacecraft got to the equivalent of the moon orbit in 9 hours. So that was really moving. It's got an average speed all the way to Pluto, an average speed of 10 miles per second, so that's pretty good. You know, it will get there in 2015. So a lot of the people that they chose to work on this thing are on the young side. This way they know they'll be around, and, you know, being a 9-year mission, the thing took off last year, 2006. It should arrive to Pluto system. And I say system because they have now found that Pluto has three of them. Charon and discoverer of it that named it. He wanted to call it Charon after his wife, but they call it Charon. And other two moons, it'll investigate all three, and it'll eventually give us solid pictures. You just have very hazy pictures. We really don't know what the surface of Pluto looks like, you know, from the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, you get some kind of a, you know, if you see pictures of it, it just kind of looks like dark light spots. Well, this thing's going to take super pictures as it wins by New Horizons. Won't orbit it. It'll keep going past Pluto, and New Horizons will be eventually going out to the Kuiper Belt to investigate some Kuiper object before it fails. They figure after it passes Pluto, you've got a couple of 2-3 years left before it's planned and mission, I think. So back to NES, this is WS2M.
Is it going to see Neptune?
That's not in line. What they call that, the grand tour when Voyager 1 went married. But if you look at the overview, if you would go to the north above the solar system and look down, you can see Neptune is like way past. If you look at Pluto, call that 12 o'clock, you know, Neptune is out like around 9 o'clock. So is Saturn, and so is Uranus. So it's a direct shot that between Jupiter and Pluto.
Okay, sorry to hang everybody up. Hey, Dick. Thank you, by the way.
Yeah, 10 miles per second is what you said. Average speed for 3,600 seconds per hour. Therefore, that is 36,000 miles per hour. That is moving. Earth orbit of a space shuttle is 17,500 miles an hour. Twice that would be 35,000 miles an hour. So it's another 5% stronger, faster, and twice the velocity of the space shuttle. Way beyond escape velocity. I think escape velocity is 7 miles a second. I think moving average 10 miles per second. Pluto is 39 astronomical units. I take the 8 minutes and multiply it by 39. I end up with, here we go. Did that wrong. 39 times 8 is 312 minutes, divided by 60, and it's 5.2 hours. So, approximate speed of light time of a signal from that New Horizons spacecraft back to Earth is around 5.2 hours. One way. Just think about what the delay line is like. Say, for instance, you do a very careful navigating job, and you find out that you want to do a mid-course correction, pretty close to the time it's going to encounter Pluto. You want to move a little bit closer, a little bit higher up, or whatever. You're going to do a mid-course correction. You're going to do a bearing. And the way you do that is that you very carefully calculate what you want the machine to do. You tell it to fold down its antenna, steer itself in this direction, to double check that the navigation is correct, that it's sighting on the right stars, It blasts the rocket for X number of seconds. After that, it reestablishes the pointing star, readjusts itself in orientation, aims the antenna back to Earth, and said, aha, I did it. Okay, so you're going to give it a command to go through all of this sequence in order to do the mid-course correction. But you want to make sure that the command got received correctly. So you transmit all this data up, it receives, it's received at the spacecraft 5.2 hours later. And at the end of that command, you say, I want to be double sure that you heard me correctly. So feed this back to me before you do it. Don't do it yet. Tell me what you heard. So if the satellite takes a half hour to an hour to get the message, and then it sends it back to you, so 5.2 hours up, an hour for the whole message to be received, 5.2 hours back, 11 or 12 hours later, you find out what the satellite heard, and you carefully check that and say, did it hear the right command? Were there errors? But it only bubbles through a certain distance and doesn't go very far if the spacing is close enough. And so if it bubbles through a tenth of a wavelength, in my example, and you're more than a tenth of a wavelength above the ground, then the RF energy that's bubbling through that space doesn't get a chance to touch the ground, doesn't get a chance to heat the ground, and you can go to a wider spacing. The bottom line of all this is you take a look at a station master or a communications product antenna, one of these vertical collinear things that you use at the repeater sites, and the ground plane radio in that case is these three little stubs every 120 degrees tilted down at a 45 degree angle from parallel, and they do a beautiful job of serving as the counterpoise, because the whole antenna is so far elevated above ground, all you've got to do with that, those stubs is to stop the majority of the RF energy from flowing down the outside of the coax cable. That's a very good counterpoise once it's elevated. So enough ground plane radios on the ground work like a charm. As you take any of those radios and raise them above the ground, in general, you're making an improvement. And if enough of them are raised above the ground, you can lower the number of radios and get the same performance. And if you raise the whole antenna far enough, three tiny little radios a quarter wavelength long will do the job beautifully. That's what the station master is. So there's no hard, fast rules on this thing that you can tell. If you look at the picture in any of the manuals you're studying, it'll lead you to believe that the dipole has got to be a completely parallel piece of wire, parallel to the ground, or sag in the middle, and they show that as a diagram of a dipole. Nobody builds a dipole like that. The transmission line hanging in the middle creates a sag so that it's a V-shape instead of an inverted V. And there are guys who support the antenna in the center, and let the end droop way down, and they call it an inverted V. It's a very effective antenna. There are guys who don't have enough property, and they zigzag the antenna and make right angle bends and whatever. Bend them up, bend them down, left and right. It all works. It all works. And once you tweak the standing wave ratio versus frequency, when you finally get your configuration that fits on your particular piece of property, between your particular trees, you may find that the whole antenna is tuned a little bit high or a little bit low. If you add or subtract a little bit of wire with the ends or clip leaves or pasting on wires by twisting them together, and you can make the antenna resonant at your center frequency. Putting up simple dipole-like antennas is a lot easier than you think. If you make it wrong, the worst that will happen is your standing wave ratio meter will read a little bit high, and your transmitter will go into a self-protect mode and start transmitting a little less power. That's not the end of the world. You're on the air. And by the measurements you make by borrowing somebody's standing wave ratio meter, you find out what's going on, and you know which direction to make the correction. A little bit like a blind man walking up the hill. You know, the tilt on your feet tells you which way is uphill. In your case, moving high and low in frequency and seeing the standing wave ratio go up or down tells you whether you're a little bit above or below center, and you know which way to go. K2KU1, K2RIW for TechNet.
Okay, very good answer. I hope that satisfies the person that's listening. Next question is also, I bought a vertical antenna for 40 meters. It's a commercial antenna, full-size 40-meter antenna. And I put the radios on, everything exactly in two directions. I took my MFJ antenna analyzer, and I connected it at the bottom connector of the vertical antenna where it joins up elevated, an elevated vertical with elevated, also with elevated radial, slanted approximately around 45 degrees. With the MFJ at the antenna, the SWR is 1.5 at a particular frequency. If I hook the coax onto it, by the way, also brand new coax cable. If I hook the coax on, when I go to the other end of the coax, my SWR is 4.2. What is happening? Over.
So, if I understand correctly, he puts the dummy load at the far end of the coax, and he measures 4.2. Somebody unfortunately talked to me, and I missed some of the details. Tell me a little bit of the details again, Mel.
Okay, briefly. He puts the SWR bridge at the antenna site, and his SWR is 1.5. He connects the cable on at that point. He moves on the connector. He goes into the radio shack, puts the MFJ antenna analyzer in the radio shack on the same frequency, and the SWR jumps up to 4.2 from 1.5. Dick, over.
Okay. And so we're assuming that it's a 50-ohm calibrated standing wave ratio bridge, that it's being operated correctly right at the antenna, and it measures something low, like 1.2, and then a good piece of coax, and the quickest way to find out if the piece of coax is good, most of the time, is with an ohmmeter. Semiconductor, you measure very small number of ohms. Shield to shield, very small number of ohms. And then shield to semiconductor, almost infinity. So, you have no shorts in the cable, and you're getting good contact between the two ends. Under those circumstances, when you come back into the shack, the standing wave ratio should be slightly lower than it was at the antenna, because the coax already is 50 ohms, just like the standing wave ratio bridge, and it's got a little bit of insertion loss, so the signal going out there, it's got a little bit of loss, coming back, the reflection from the standing wave ratio, it's got a little bit of loss. Therefore, the VIS-WR you measure in the shack should be slightly lower than what you measure at the antenna. And here he's measuring something tremendously higher. It's a mystery. There's either something wrong with the coax, or something wrong with the way the connection to the antenna for the counterpoise radio is taking place, so that the coax itself is hot. The outer shield of the coax is radiating energy. It's not being properly connected between the shield, counterpoise, and the counterpoise connection of the antenna itself. So, everything I know tells me the VIS-WR in the shack has got to be lower. The fact that it's tremendously higher tells me something's wrong with that coax. Do a very good inspection of the connector at both ends. Do an ohmmeter test between the ends. Worst comes to worst, get borrowed somebody else's piece of the coax and just lay it on the ground temporarily, but run another piece of coax cable from that antenna to the shack and repeat the measurement. Under normal circumstances, it can't go that way. That's my understanding. Probably yours also, Bill. KQKUY, KQRIW in the second.